Good afternoon. So hopefully you're here for CS3330, computer architecture. If you're not, well, sorry. So I'm Charles Rice. So I'll be teaching this class along with Samira Khan. Please stand up. Our plan is that there are two lectures, you may have noticed. Our plan is to give the same lecture in both rather than preparing two different lectures on the same topic and trying to make sure it works that we share assignments. So our plan is that I will be doing roughly half the lectures and Samira will be doing roughly half. And we'll be combined labs, same assignments, and all that. So this class is building on topics you may or may not remember from 2150, but going down about how hardware actually works. So we're going to look at these layers of abstraction. So we're going to look at some higher level language, the way that we normally do programs. Our choice of language for this class is going to be C. So we're going to look at, you know, what C looks like. C is very related to C++. There's a reason we're choosing C over C++ in this class. It's mostly because there are features of C++ we don't really care about. We're going to talk about how assembly works. We're going to use the specific example of x86-64 assembly, mainly because it's what most of the laptops and desktops and remote access machines you have access to use. And because maybe you remember it from 2150. We're going to look at machine code, and you would think that I would say we're using x86 machine code, and we aren't. We're using something called y86, which is a machine code very related to x86, invented by our textbook, but meant to be much simpler. So we could teach real x86 machine code, but it's complicated in ways which are not educational at all. There's lots of history. x86 is meant to be kind of compatible with processors which, you know, had only kilobytes of memory, and the machine code reflects that in ways which are mostly annoying rather than actually useful. And we're going to talk about, given that machine code, that way of, you know, giving our bits to say what to do, how we actually build hardware to do that. So we're going to use a hardware design language. So something kind of like a programming language that's not intended to compile to assembly and machine code, but is intended to compile down to a description of hardware you could physically build. And this is the sort of thing people do when they're designing real processors. They don't actually take out their electron microscope and lay out each individual transistor. They use some abstraction layer, and then a computer program looks at that description and produces a list of what you should put transistors here, 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 and here, and that's what's actually built. So we're going to be looking at something like that. The one we'll be using is something called HCLRS, which is based on a thing called HCL from our textbook, which is a kind of simplified version of the real tools that would be are used for this. And below that are things, gates, transistors, wires, and registers. We'll be talking about these from a perspective of how you use them, what they do functionally. We won't be talking about how they work internally. We won't be talking much about how you use gates to like build an adder. That's a different course. It's 2330. We'll just be talking more from a perspective of, we know these things exist, like what are their properties that are relevant when we're using this hardware design language. So first, a brief talk about why we're using C, since that's the topic we're going to be starting fairly early in the semester. So as I said, C is related to C++. So C is almost a subset of C++. So it's almost the case that if you take a C program, it's going to be a valid C++ program. This is not quite true. Because of some little issues which are not very important but come up in any large C program. But for the most part, if you look at a large C program, it's just a C++ program that doesn't use classes or new delete or IO streams and things like that. And the reason we're using C is that C was written at a time where compilers were more of a daunting thing to make than they are now. And it was designed to have a very direct correspondence to assembly. So it's designed so that you could make a C compiler, and it would be very straightforward to decide exactly what assembly to produce for every C instruction. And this means that you can use C to think about what assembly should look like without worrying about as many details about each assembly instruction and exactly what registers to use and things like that. And so that's very nice for a course like this, where we want to like talk about what a loop looks like without, and each time figuring out how to translate that loop to assembly in order to talk about how it affects the hardware. So because there's this direct correspondence, we can write C code and talk about what it should do on the hardware with a natural translation to assembly. And in the olden days, it was the case that that natural translation to assembly is what your compiler would actually do. You know, that you could do this manually and it would be the same as your compiler. But compilers are more clever these days. So compilers can do something more indirect than what we'll talk about being the straightforward translation. So they might realize, you know, you don't really need to add here. I'll do something else, even though there's a plus sign in the C code. They can decide things like that as long as they don't change the answer your program gives. So it won't be the case that in reality that this illusion we want that the C code corresponds directly to the assembly code actually holds. But it's close enough for us to discuss C code in a way that's useful for understanding the hardware. This is a warning you should be aware of, especially when you write C code in practice, that the assembly that's generated, especially if you turn on optimizations, will always be what it should be based on your knowledge of what C is, you know, built with translating to assembly in mind. And because we're using C, your first piece of homework and the lab write-up for yesterday, for those of you who bothered to read it, is to get a Unix environment with a C compiler. And you have several options. So one option is lab accounts and SSH access, remote access to the lab machines. I know you don't have lab accounts yet. That should happen by this weekend. And you should get an email, like in 2150, with the Unix lab accounts credentials. That will work. You can have Linux. You can either have Linux natively on some machine or in a VM. And if you use the 2150 VM image, that should work perfectly fine. So if you're comfortable with that from 2150, you can keep using it in this class, and you should be able to do all the assignments in it. Or you can use some sort of online IDE. Students have had success with all of these options. But for some assignments, you will need a Linux environment, a 64-bit Linux environment. For other assignments, you will need some sort of Unix-like environment. And in general, if you have trouble setting up an environment, we don't have the time to do individualized tech support on like why a VM doesn't work on your old laptop. So we might give a little bit of an effort, but ultimately, you know, our answer is going to be, well, this first option is the one we're going to get working for you. If you have trouble, like we might make a best effort to help you out with like getting a VM working on your own laptop, but if there's problems with that, we're not going to have a TA spend 30 minutes with you getting it working. Okay. So, side C, we have assembly. So I mentioned that we're using x86 64 assembly, so that should be the same assembly you all learned in 2150. So who here took 2150 or an equivalent course that did not use 64-bit, that's with 16 registers, x86 assembly? Anyone? Okay, good. So we're past the era when 2150 used 32-bit x86 assembly, and I don't have to talk about that. Okay, so in theory, this means you all know this, because the week and a half in 2150 gives a great impression on people's minds. So you all know it. You got all those assignments, aced them, and remember everything from it. All the call stacks and push and So we know that this is not, in fact, really true. So we're going to start with a bit of assembly review, including covering some things you didn't see or saw very, very briefly in 2150. Notably in this course, as you might see from this example here, we are not using the assembly syntax you used in 2150. We're using AT&T syntax, so-called, because it's the syntax that the tools made by AT&T Labs back in the 70s used. So we're using that assembly syntax. The reason we're using that assembly syntax is because our textbook here uses it, and it would be a shame to be inconsistent with that. We don't care if you use tools that generate Intel assembly in the course, but what we're handing in is always going to be AT&T syntax. So we're going to talk about what AT&T syntax actually means and a few other things. And our first lab, which is next week, is we're going to give you an executable and have you use a debugger and or a disassembler and figure out what input it expects. So that's the lab, and there's a homework, which is to do more of the input it expects. So that's our lab next week. That's going to be helping you practice with assembly, and on next Tuesday we'll go over a bit of assembly review to help you out with that. Okay, so machine code. We're using Y86. This means we're also using a Y86 assembly at some point. And so this is our textbook's subset of x86-64. So all the instructions in Y86 are x86-64 instructions, but a lot of instructions are missing, which is good, because if you pick up Intel's manual, which would be nice to have as a prop, but I probably wouldn't want to have it in my backpack, the instruction set reference is two volumes of like 1,000 pages each. So you wouldn't actually want to do that, because remember, you're not coding in it, you're implementing this as in a hardware description language. So keeping things simple here is a net win for you, because yes, it's going to be a lot harder to write useful assembly programs with less instructions, but it's sure going to be a lot easier to implement the hardware description for it with less instructions. So this is much simpler, as I said, than the real x86-64 encoding. But in spite of that, it's a lot more complicated than the machine code example you saw in 2150. So most notably, it's a variable length encoding. So different instructions take up different numbers of bytes. In IBCM, if you remember, everything was the same length. It has a full register set. ICBM had like one or two. Here we have 15. You might say, why not 16? We'll get to that later in the semester. It has actual conditional jumps, like you would see in x86, so you can do all your jump less than and so on, and comparisons. And it has the stack manipulation instructions push and pop that you're used to from writing x86 assembly, with which it would be awkward without those to implement the calling convention that you're used to. A lot of this course, we're going to be talking about using this hardware design language and implementing a processor in it. And one sort of question people often have is, like, why are we bothering to do sort of a processor implementation thing when this is not something almost anyone, not everyone, but almost anyone in this class actually is looking to do, like, career-wise, something like that. What should someone who expects to have a career entirely on the software side of things, because you're not probably computer engineering majors if you're taking this class, what should you expect to get out of this? And our hope is, by having this practice writing a hardware description that can actually implement a processor, and that conceptually, we won't do it, could be compiled down to something we could physically build into a chip you could put in a processor, in a computer, and have it work, is that you'll learn things that are useful as even a software developer. So one thing that we're going to talk about is program performance. So when we look at, typical programs, you know, our current notion is we have some ways of guessing performance. So you have very high level ways. You have asymptotic analysis. And that's great for, I know what this design of this data structure is, and I want to know whether it's a really bad idea or not. So we're not going to talk about that kind of performance. We're going to talk about sort of smaller level performance differences because we're not dealing with algorithmic changes. But your current notion of performance is probably that, if I look at a program, each instruction takes up 1 unit of time. And you may have heard of clock cycles, and your naive idea of what a clock cycle is that every clock cycle, we run one instruction, and that's it. And this means that might be, the first notion, that's what a simple processor would do. But in reality, while the number of instructions, yes, it's really important, there's a lot more going on, especially in modern hardware, that affects its performance. And there's two big issues in there. One is that there's parallelism in modern hardware. So modern hardware, which is fast, does things in parallel. It executes parts of multiple instructions at the same time. And it needs multiple things to do in order for you to get maximum efficiency out of the hardware. So, for example, on a modern processor like in my laptop, there might be hundreds of instructions that are in some partial stage of execution, or some part of them is done, but they're not completely done. And that's common in modern processors. And if you want to take advantage of this as a programmer and understand how can I make my program, be faster, you're going to be throwing away a lot of performance if you insist on imagining the computer doing one thing and then the other, if it can do tens or hundreds of things at once. The other big issue is caching. So, on modern computers, accessing things that were recently accessed is a lot faster, which means that if you want to get most of the performance out of your program, you need to take advantage of this. The difference between accessing something which is not cached, that wasn't recently used and is kept someplace fast, is something like 1,000 times slower in many cases. And you, as a programmer, can design your programs to make sure that caching works well for them, that the way hardware is trying to make your programs fast actually works for your program. And these are both issues which aren't algorithmic efficiency. So I didn't talk about anything about what happens when my data set size gets bigger here. I'm just talking about doing multiple things at once, even if I have a fixed number of things to do, which if you remember Big O, Big O doesn't make sense when your input size never changes. But these are all sort of orthogonal. These are things you can do in addition to worrying about algorithmic efficiency. So once you've chosen the most asymptotically efficient algorithm, if you want to make something actually fast, if you're worried about the performance, these are things you'll need to worry about in addition to whether you're using the right algorithm. So any questions about any of these? So other thing we're going to talk about is what compilers are and do in more detail. So you've seen kind of sort of a high-level overview of compilers generating assembly in 2150. We'll talk in more detail about what compilers are trying to do and what we should expect them to do. And this hopefully will help you when you get weird compiler and linker errors, you might have a better idea of what's actually going on to understand them. If you want to make compilers, you want to understand how is my processor actually going to execute this program so I can generate not just some assembly that works, but the right assembly to be efficient, take advantage of that. And when you're debugging applications, like you're going to be doing with the executable we give you without source code in the lab, sometimes you want to figure out what's really going on. And to do that, you need to reason about what did the compiler actually produce for this program? Why is it crashing and so on? So another thing we're going to talk about are things related to what I'll call weird program behaviors. So part of what's in hardware that you haven't seen in 2150 very much is that parts of processors are designed to help the operating system. And there are these features which are responsible for example, segmentation faults. Those are a thing that exists because the hardware has a feature designed to help the operating system make sure programs don't stomp over each other. And so by understanding how that sort of operating system support works, this will certainly help you if you need to write an OS. You definitely need to know, how does the hardware let me get a segmentation fault instead of a program breaking my OS? And if you are the person writing the program with a segmentation fault, knowing what exactly does and doesn't trigger a segmentation fault will help you understand how to debug a program which has one and you can't figure out why. So, any questions about any of these goals and topics? Okay, so let's have an interlude for some kind of course material. So a topic which doesn't really fit anywhere, but that we want you to know. So powers of two are a thing which comes up an awful lot when we're talking about hardware. And it will be really, really useful later on in this class if you can efficiently translate between a power of two and some nice abbreviation for it. And the way we recommend doing this is that we can say you can memorize or figure out on demand these first few powers of two. And then in this class, we're going to write something like for this 2 to the 11th here, we're going to write, say, 2k usually. So I know some of you might be complaining, wait, in SI units, that's not 2048. Yes, I know. Generally in this class, we will always mean powers of two with k. I will try to be explicit on exams and the like that I mean it. But generally, when I write 2k, I mean the power of two thing, that's that. And generally, k is 2 to the 10th, m is 2 to the 20, g is 2 to the 30 in this case. So these are the powers of two, which are, you know, almost 1,000, almost 1,000,000, and so on. We'll use the exact power of two because in hardware we're going to be dealing with bits. The power of 10 is not going to be a thing which makes sense, and usually we will want, if we have 2k, exactly 2k of something. So this is 2k, this is 4k, this is 8k, and so on. And you might notice that this is equal to 10 plus 1, and 2 to the 1 is 2, and this is equal to, say, 10 plus 3, and 2 to the 3 is 8. And that is not a coincidence. So this 2 here is, in fact, an 8. You can, in fact, get by looking at the power pretty directly. You don't need to actually do the multiplication to get 4096 and then figure it out that way. You can do this shorthand where you look at the first digit in base 10 of the power and say that's going to be k, m, g, and so on. And the next digit tells you the thing that goes in front of it from this, the short table of powers of two over here. So any questions on this? Okay, so given that there are no questions, so why don't we write in that same way? I would recommend using a piece of paper, but you don't have to. Each of these powers of two. Thank you. No. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, apparently no one. Okay, so the trick here is we're gonna look, is that as a quick shortcut, you can look at this first digit here, and that's gonna tell us the postfix, whether it's K, M, G, or so on. So in this case, we know that because of that, it's something 30 plus 5. So the postfix is that 30 thing that corresponds to 30, which is G. And then we have 2 to the 5th, which you could memorize as 32, or you could figure that on demand. That's not actually ridiculous to do on paper, unlike 2 to the 35, which doing in base 10 on paper would not be worth anyone's time. Similarly, for two to the 21, we look at the 2 here, and that corresponds to M for million, and the 2 to the 1 is 2. It would be 2 to the 0 would be 1, so that's 2M. For 2 to the 9, this is the one where hopefully you don't blindly look at the first digit and realize that this is 0, 9, so the first thing is 0, which is no letter, so that's just 512. And for 2 to the 14, we have a 1 here, which is K, and 2 to the 4, which is not 4, but 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, which is 16. So 16K. Yes? So, question is, could you write this as, say, 1/2K? You could, I won't, generally, but you can. So just like you can do this process going forward, you can also do it going backwards. So if we give you a bunch of abbreviated things, like you might see in a specification for a processor, it might tell you the sizes of various things, translating those back to powers of 2. So the form of answer I want is that this equals two to the something. Does anyone need more time? Not? Okay. So, feature here is to memorize what the G, K, and so on are. So G is 2 to the 30. You can just like write out a little table. 0 is nothing, 10 is K, 20 is M, 30 is G. I heard vague notions of people not knowing what T was, which is fine because that wasn't on the previous slide. So how could you? But that's the next one for Terra, Giga, Mega. Yes.
Is that a hold up for like if you keep going, like for like
So the question is, do we always have something which is approximately the same as the power of 10 as we do to add 10 to the power of 2? The answer is generally yes, though the notion of approximately becomes more and more approximate the higher you go. But for this class, we will always use that because, as I said, in computers, we're not, in processors at least, we're not going to have powers of 10 naturally, but we will have powers of 2. So we can follow that same procedure of 128 times 2 to the 10. We can know 128 is 2 to the 7th, which I know by memorizing. You might know by computing it. And similarly for all the others. Any questions on any of these or the forward exercises? So I'm mentioning this because later on in the course, I promise you there will be a point where we'll be happy if you know how to do this. It won't be extremely soon. There might be little things which come up, but there will be a point where you'll be happy about knowing that. Okay, so why don't I take this opportunity, since we're kind of halfway in the lecture, to do some logistic stuff. So as I mentioned at the beginning of lecture, Samir and I will be splitting up the lectures by days. It will be the same lecture from the same person in each section. So I intend to record my lectures. That's what this I'm holding here is. I probably made the audio sound kind of bad. And I'm also doing a screen capture, and that will be posted. So we strongly recommend you attend lecture, but the material is available. It's available primarily to help you review, not as a substitute for coming to lecture. And as a discipline thing, I would note that many people, not everyone, some people can manage not coming to lecture and looking at every lecture video and things like that, but many people who promise themselves they'll do that don't. And it usually probably doesn't go great for them. I intend to have every lecture recorded. There might be some technical difficulties someday because it's not a professional recording setup with someone doing it back there. We also have labs, and labs are electronic and generally possible to submit remotely. There's actually, this slide is wrong. There is no exception this semester. They're all possible to do without actually going to lab. That said, you probably should go to lab if you want help. Our labs will be staffed. And because we have electronic remote submission, we generally will not be enforcing that you actually go to the lab you are registered for. However, if the lab is full, obviously someone who's actually registered for that lab should get priority. So, mentioned labs. So we have a bunch of kinds of coursework. So one thing we have in this course is quizzes, which are pre-post each week of lecture, except not this week and not pre-next week. So these are things which will be done online. They are timed, and the pre-ones will involve reading. That means you probably should actually have a copy of the textbook. Also, having a copy of the textbook is really helpful for the HCL assignments. Like, really, really helpful. Like, the textbook basically tells you how to do parts of the assignment that people have lots of trouble with. So we have labs. My grading for the lab is something along the lines of, did you make reasonable progress? Now, since it's electronic submission, I can't actually grade on effort. I need to look at the file you submitted and make a decision. Did you actually work on this? I don't talk to a TA and find out, were you working on this? So that means there is some amount of work that you need to get done, but often it will be less work than actually completing the whole lab. Generally, my intention is that pretty much everyone who actually works for 75 minutes on it should get full credit. But I need to look at what you actually submit. So you might make guesses like if you submit something that doesn't compile and you work 75 minutes, probably not going to get full credit. There are homework assignments. For the most part, the structure of the homework assignments is that there will be a lab and there will be a homework assignment that is extremely related to the lab, which is yet another reason you probably should actually do the lab. So on labs, collaboration is permitted. You can work with one or more other people in this class on labs. On homeworks, they are individual assignments. You are not to share code. You can ask questions of each other that do not involve sharing code or pseudocode, but are general conceptual questions. As a rule of thumb, if you wouldn't mind asking the question in front of me to another student and me hearing it, you probably shouldn't be giving that kind of help. So you also have some exams. So there's going to be a midterm, two midterms, and a final. The midterms will be in class. The final will be at a combined final time, which is on the final schedule. The exams will generally be multiple choice or short answer entirely, so you can rate them quickly. We will not have you like write code on that. That's what the homeworks are for. So note that there's labs, lectures, and homeworks. I know that these aren't quite as synced as you might like, because we need to cover material before you need it in labs and homeworks. And sometimes there are labs which build on each other, and this means that there can be a surprisingly long gap between when we cover something in class and when you actually do the homework on it. I'm sorry, I'm trying to make some adjustments this semester which will make this less bad than it has been in the past, but it's still likely to be an annoyance to some students. Just be prepared for that. That just because what you see in lecture isn't on the homework now doesn't mean it won't be later. Okay. So quizzes. So I mentioned these earlier. So they're linked off the course website. Sometime next week I'll probably show you an example of that, closer to when you actually have to do it and when people have finished at dropping the class. You don't have to worry about missing people. So there'll be a quick quiz, which will generally be released on a Saturday evening and due Tuesday at 10:45 a.m., which is before this class. That's why it's due then, so I don't have people doing the quiz in class. And there'll be a post quiz released Thursday evening, like 6-7 p.m., sometime after I can be sure that the contents of the post quiz actually match what we covered in lecture, and due the following Monday afternoon. The quiz has a 90-minute time limit online, so once you go to the website and click start the quiz, you'll have 90 minutes to complete it. Generally, it's going to be like 5-6 multiple choice questions, so this time limit is extremely generous, and you should not have time problems. However, historically, quizzes have been consistently the lowest part of almost every student's grade. Consistently. And this is in spite of, as mentioned here, we're going to drop the lowest 10%, so approximately 2 of the quizzes are dropped. Even after that, consistently the lowest part of everyone's grade. So keep that in mind. And I will demo the quizzes next week as a reminder that you actually have to do them, because I'm sure you will forget, because there's no quiz to do until after next week's lecture. Yes. The question is, why are quizzes the worst part?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. So part of it is probably that some of the questions are, because they're written quickly, are inadvertently harder than I expect. Part of it is that for the pre-quizzes, many people don't do the reading and just try to do the pre-quiz by having the book in front of them, which works better for some people than others. And part of it is that I think some people try to do the quiz very quickly and doesn't work out. I'm not sure exactly what mix of things it is. They probably are actually relatively hard questions, because my philosophy is you have 90 minutes, I should be able to ask multiple choice questions which are harder than we'd ask on an exam. And I note that quizzes, despite the name, since they're done online, we're not silly. We're not gonna say, yeah, it's online, but we want you not to look at your textbook or your notes. No, you can look at those things. You can't, do not ask other people. Like, don't post a Stack Overflow question. You know, don't, I am your fellow student. But you absolutely are allowed to like look at the slides when you're doing the quiz. Okay. So I mentioned we had assignments. So I have a late policy. So if you have an exceptional circumstance in general, if you're sick or something like that, something comes up that might deserve special treatment, let us know. We can often be flexible, especially if we know in advance. We can often do something about it. The general no questions asked late policy for homeworks only, for labs, and for quizzes, there is no late submission. If you can submit labs late and I will grade them for you and tell you how you did, but you will not get credit. For homeworks only, if you submit it 0 to 48 hours late, we will subtract 10%. We'll take your score and multiply it times 90%. If you submit it 48 to 72 hours late, we will subtract 15%. We'll take your score and multiply it by 85%. If you submit it later than that, we will not give you credit. For quizzes and labs, no. For quizzes, the big reason is our quiz system, for the convenience of you, those of you who like studying from the quizzes, automatically releases the answer key when the quiz is done. And we don't really want to have people submitting a late quiz when they can go to their friend and actually get the answer key. So that's not really something we want. And also we want people to feel free to discuss the quizzes after they're done, like on Piazza or something. And it'd be unfortunate if we had to have some extra time to deal with that. For labs, some of the labs we could probably allow late submissions on, but for some of them, we release something which is effectively an answer to help people start on the homework. And therefore, we can't really accept late submissions because you're submitting something late where we gave you an answer. And so for something like quizzes or labs, if you're actually ill and can't make it unexpectedly, we will usually make some accommodation other than accepting a late submission. Okay. So for contacting us, so we will have office hours. So office hours and Piazza are probably the big ways of getting help in the class beyond talking to TAs directly in lab. Office hours will be posted on a calendar on the website. If you don't know where the website is, it's linked off the Colab. It has all the information you need, all the assignment write-ups, the schedule, copies of the lecture notes. It will have links to lecture recordings and so on. The office hours will also be there on the main page in a calendar, which should start sometime next week, probably after the first lab. There should be plenty of them. I still need to figure out when all my TAs can hold office hours and when I'm not going to have meetings to hold office hours, but please use them. So any questions about logistics? Yes. The question is, does it matter what version of the textbook you have? As long as you have a third edition, you should be okay. My understanding is some of the softcover versions don't have color diagrams, which is the biggest annoyance, but I think that usually isn't an issue. The softcover versions, like the international edition, I think people have done okay with, but I haven't seen it, so I'm not sure. Yeah.
How much can we work ahead?
How much can you work ahead? So on the website, I mark some assignments as tentative. If they're marked as tentative, I'm not going to promise that big things won't change. But it's unlikely that if I posted something that the real assignment is going to be very dissimilar. In some cases, there will be some system I need to set up that isn't set up yet for assignments, in which case, you know, you just can't start it for that reason. Yeah. Where are office hours going to be held? So the calendar will tell you, probably professor office hours will be mostly held in professor offices, and other office hours will be mostly held in stacks, but we might occasionally use other rooms like Rice 436 or something like that. So other questions? Yeah.
What's the breakdown between
the
exams and
That's what it looks like. There's a page on the course website about grading. It most notably notes that we generally do not curve in this course, so we do some adjustment from the raw score of exams based on how difficult we think the exam is, but other than that, we compute your grade in this way and have thresholds that are fixed at the beginning of the semester for what an A minus A, B, B plus, and so on are, and that's what we'll assign. Yeah?
Is every homework and lab weighted equally?
The question is, every homework and lab weighted equally? No. In particular, the labs have significantly less weight than the homework. And some homeworks are weighted a little less than others. For the most part, they're about the same. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's go on to more of our core topics about processors and such. So, talk about what our computers look like. So sort of a basic notion of what our processor is that we have a processor which does actual computation. This here is a electron microscope photo of a processor, pretty old one. And it's somehow connected to memory, that thing where we actually store the data for the processor, and hopefully to I/O devices. And a common notion is that there's this one single bus. This is maybe not the way current processors work, but a common design has been that there's this single bus that connects the processor to its outside devices, and it sends requests, and they get routed by something like labeled here on an I/O bridge to memory and to these I/O devices. So basically, the processor sends on the system bus an address, and then it gets back some data. So like machine code, or bytes from memory, or information about a key press from a keyboard. But it sends out these addresses and gets back data that corresponds to that address, whether it's data from memory or data from an I/O device which has been assigned that address. And so our typical notion of what our processor does is that we have this program counter, the current instruction we're executing, and it sends out this program counter, and the memory ends up sending back the machine code at that address, and the processor goes through this cycle, sending out the next program counter and getting the code at that address. And similarly, when the processor is doing I/O, maybe this instruction says, hey, why don't you send out a request for I/O, and it sends a request to this special address assigned to, say, our keyboard, and our keyboard sends back something just like the memory would send back, except this is our key press information. So we have this notion of memory here that we communicate with in this sort of back and forth way. So our memory has a bunch of these addresses, and there's something there, and the processor can send requests to get to and from these addresses. So what is memory? And I think you've kind of seen this in 2150. So our notion of memory for this class is that memory is this big array of bytes. So really, it's that thing we talk to on the I/O bridge. That's what we call memory. But for most of this class, we're just going to consider only the data storage part, not any of the other things that might be attached. And we're just going to say it's this array of bytes. Each byte has an address and a value. And we have values at every possible address, conceptually. And it's just bytes, and the CPU doesn't actually get back push, it gets back some number, and it needs to decide how to interpret that. And the CPU decides how to interpret each byte just based on what reason it had to access memory. If it's accessing memory because the program counter had a particular value, it's going to interpret that machine code. If it's accessing memory because a move instruction said to access at that address, it's going to interpret it as a value to put in a register, and so on. So you note that I've here drawn memory in a particular way. I've drawn it so the lowest address is on the bottom and the highest address is on top. It is equally valid for me to draw memory in the other way. Usually in this class, I will end up drawing memory in this way here, with, but that doesn't actually change anything about what I'm actually showing you. So like it's the same memory regardless of which way I show it. But one thing we will care about with memory is how we interpret multiple bytes. So you've like briefly seen this in 2150, but I know from experience that most people don't remember it very well. So one thing we care about is endianness. So here I have some C++ code. So I get a pointer which contains the address hex 42000. And I want to read that as an int. On my system, ints are 4 bytes. So I'm somehow going to get these 4 bytes and print them out as a decimal number. And there are 2 options which are equally valid for how I interpret these 4 bytes. So one option is I could decide the thing at the lowest address is the least significant part of the number. It's the part which, when I write it in my standard English order, goes at the end. The other is I can decide that the part with the numerically lowest address is the most significant part of the number. It goes at the beginning when I write it in my English order. So these differences, endianness, and because we're going to deal with memory in different size values, and in particular, we're going to often have to interpret multiple bytes as one value, we need to choose some interpretation. And probably we want to choose one of these and not some third option, even though we conceptually could have a third option where we order these in some other way. So this first option is called little endian. And the way I remember this is least significant, lowest address for little. Little is least is lowest. And big is least is highest, or most significant is lowest. So it's always about the name. I can think of it being about what the first address, the lowest address is. Is it the little part of the number or the big part of the number? So these 2 interpretations. In this class, we will always be referring to the little endian version. We will pretty much never use big endian, and the reason why is x86 is little endian. Anytime it has to make this decision, it makes the little endian version. So any questions about Endianness? Yes. How do I decide which byte is most significant? So significance means how much does it affect the value as a number? So the most significant byte is the one which, if I changed it, is going to have the most effect on the overall number. So in the little endian case, if I change the 00 to something else, it's going to change the value by at most 256, 255. Here, if I change this 00 to something else, any little changes are going to have a huge effect on this decimal value here. And that's how you know it's most significant, because it has the most effect. Any other questions? Okay, so that's endianness. So we have our memory, and when we're running a program, we have a particular layout of memory that you may or may not remember from 2150. That typically we have a stack, and we have code, we have a heap that where memory gets allocated. And here I'm showing you the typical layout of a program with some addresses highlighted on 64-bit Linux. So in other operating systems, some things might be different. So on x86, 64-bit Linux. So one thing that's going to be true is that our stack is going to grow what we're going to call down. That means the top of the stack has the smallest address. So when we add to the stack, we subtract from the top. Our stack pointer goes to a lower address. That's always going to be true in this class. So if we have something on the stack, the next thing on the stack, in this way I drew on this picture, where the lowest address is at the bottom, is down. So another thing you might notice about this picture is that there's these big holes. So we'll talk about what those actually are later. But we have all this unused space in our program layout that we'll talk about much later in the semester about what that actually is. But even though conceptually, the way I've shown you memory is that every byte has a value, in real programs, not actually. There's some bytes that we can't access. You know this in 2150 as what causes your program to segfault. So we have this layout of the program in memory, and we somehow get to this layout from our compiled C code. And you probably remember these compilation steps from 2150, that we have some sort of C program like this. It gets compiled into some assembly program, and you assemble that, and it produces an object file. Vaguely, maybe remembers object files, so object files after the assembly file. The object file presumably contains machine code, and that gets linked to produce our actual executable. And there's a missing piece here. So this program here, I'm calling this function called printf. We haven't discussed printf, we'll do that within a week or two. But printf is basically equivalent to cout, but it's the C version. So it uses this function called printf, and we don't have any code for printf here. And in fact, we need to have that code somewhere. And it's not in our assembly file. Our assembly file is only going to contain the stuff in this file. You might think including standard io.h has the implementation of printf, but in fact, it does not. It just has a declaration. That declaration is not going to cause the compiler to reduce the assembly for printf generally. And our assembler is not going to add it. So something in linking, something in this step needs to add it. And it needs to actually know what printf is supposed to do. We could imagine the linker has that knowledge hard-coded, but that's not actually how it's going to work. So there's going to be some other object file that we didn't provide that the compiler is going to find for us somehow. That's going to get linked in, and that's where that code's going to come from. And our executable is going to contain the code for printf and the code for our main in such a way that when we actually load it, it looks like this program layout and we can run it. And when you're doing compilation, I've shown the commands in GCC here, you know, you can do each of these steps individually. Commonly, you probably do something like, you know, this, where you just say, I have a program, I want to compile it into an executable. That does all the steps, you just don't see the files that were generated. GCC usually literally generates temporary files somewhere you don't see that are each of the steps when you do that. So let's talk a bit about what's actually in object files, so on. So here we have a simple C program. So here I'm using puts instead of printf since it's even simpler. But just hello world, turn zero, that's all it does. So I have a C program, and I want to do each of these steps I talked about. So we're going to compile it into an assembly file. That assembly file is going to turn into an object file, and we're going to turn that object file into an executable. And in order to do that, we need to get a copy of whatever implements puts here. That's going to be something we're going to somehow need to add to the executable in order for it to run. So our first step is we're going to compile this and we're going to get an assembly file. So this is what the assembly file might look like. So you may or may not remember this from 2150. So here I'm using AT&T syntax. We'll talk more about that on Tuesday, but the biggest thing to remember is that AT&T syntax puts the destination last. But you may notice that we have labels here. So we have this thing labeled .lstr, which is our string. And this is marked as part of the data. And what that means is that ultimately, when we look at our program memory layout, we want that to go into a different part of the executable than our code. That's why it's labeled that way. So we have this thing called that, and we actually refer to it here. And that needs to somehow work. And we also have just call puts. And that we need to somehow end up needing to be a call instruction, that whatever the machine code for call is, and it needs to somehow refer to puts, and we're not going to do it by name when we have the executable. So at some point, we're going to need to replace that puts with something like an address. So that's the preview of what needs to happen. So what's going to happen when we take this assembly file and turn it into an object file? So the primary thing we're going to do is we're going to produce machine code. And we're going to do this in pieces. So we have a part marked text and a part marked data. And those are going to be separate, what are called segments of the object file. And this is because in our final executable, we want to have our actual code go to a different part of memory than our data. So we're going to have them in different sections so the linker can take the code, put it in one place, take the data, put it in another place. So we'll write out our code. So we'll take, this is going to be our machine code for those assembly instructions. And we'll also have our data. So here our data is going to just be the bytes corresponding to the ASCII. So here I'm showing you things with hexadecimal and nice labels. That's not what the real object file looks like. We could have the object file have this format where it's human readable like this, but that would waste a lot of space. So generally, it will just have some sort of little binary header saying, hey, there's this many bytes of code, and then the actual code is just raw bytes in the file, and then, hey, there's this many bytes of data, then the actual bytes is raw bytes in the file. Like, I'm just showing you this so you can figure out what's in it, because I just showed you like raw hex dump that would not be useful to anyone to understand it. And so different parts of this machine code refer to different things. So for example, we have this subtract instruction, which happens to get encoded like this. That's the machine code for it on x86-64. That gets turned into. We're not going to talk about why it looks like that. You can look that up or ask me offline if you need to. We also have things like these labels here. So we have .lstr is referring to that data. And this is supposed to be the address of the string. because we're basically loading a pointer to the string so that we can call puts and give it that pointer. And if you look at the part of this machine code that corresponds to this in a real logic file, you will see zeros, which is kind of weird. Well, the string isn't actually at address zero, is it? And no, it's not. And we'll do something similar for puts. We have a call instruction, and here's where information about what function to call goes, the puts in this case, and that's zeros. So we've omitted that information from the machine code, and we've done it because we don't know where puts is, and we don't know where that string is going to end up in memory yet. Because we don't know what else is going to be linked in, we don't know where we're going to put our data yet. We haven't decided that yet when we make the object file. So the object file won't contain that information. So we need to do something about that. And what the assembler does is that we don't just write out this machine code and this data. We're going to have these omissions where the assembly said, put the string address here, where we didn't know what it was. So we'll just leave it as zeros in the machine code. And we'll write a note to ourselves saying, hey, I wrote a bunch of zeros 6 bytes into my machine code. And really, it needs to be the address of the beginning of the data segment of this file. So we'll write this note to ourselves, which is called a relocation. And similarly, we have this place where we did a call, and I will say 10 bytes into my machine code, I wrote some zeros, but that's really supposed to be the address of puts. Wherever the function puts ends up being, you need to find it and put the address there. So we have these notes about things we didn't finish when we made the machine code. So we have some holes in the machine code that we need to fill in, and these are called relocations. And this is precisely what the linker is going to be using when we ask it to use printf and actually to lay out our executable and decide where do I put everything. There's one more piece of information that's in this assembly file here that we need in the object file that I haven't written down. Anyone think of some piece of information that's important to produce the executable that we don't have yet? Yeah. What do you mean, what the file is?
Like adding where your XOR operation.
Where what? Okay. Other ideas? There's something that's written down in the assembly file that we haven't represented that we probably actually care about. Yeah.
You need a label for the main function?
Yeah, we need to know where main is. How do we know where this program starts? Like, yes, main is the first part of the text segment here, but there's no reason I had to do that. And if I wrote a function before main, you would expect execution to start at main. So we have to have that written down somewhere. Where is main? So there's another part of our object file called the symbol table. So each of our labels is going to be called a symbol. And it's going to say, hey, main, that's the thing I'm calling main, that's the first byte of my text segment. That's what I'm saying here. So then when the linker needs to produce an executable, it wants to know where does this executable start. It knows, oh, main's right there, now I know. So we have this object file, and we need to actually turn this into an executable. So one thing we're going to need is we're going to need an actual copy of puts. So presumably we have some other object file that's provided usually by the operating system or the compiler that has a copy of puts in it. And given that, our linker is going to look at these relocations, the symbol table of all the object files, and it's going to put them together and turn it into our executable. And our executable is going to contain basically just binary data that we're going to load directly into memory. So it's going to contain the code and the data all together, just ready to be copied into memory with all the addresses filled in based on where they're actually going to need to be. And so this means that what's in our executable is basically that this is loaded directly from exe file. That's going to be how it's going to work. Is that our, loading our exe file is basically we're going to copy most of our exe file to that part of memory. That's what the operating system is going to do. And our linker is going to fix up everything. So that's all the operating system needs to do when we run an executable. Is copy a piece to memory. Yeah.
If the printf is not located in the executable but somewhere else, then calling it, will that leave the program memory?
So the question is, if the printf is not located in the executable, will that leave the program memory? So here, what we're going to do is that this is so standard io.o is part of the executable. So in this notion of linking, we just put it all, it's in the executable. There's no worry about, are we calling something that's not part of the executable? And we did that, and that let us make sure we put the address that points to there in our machine code. So other questions? Yeah.
So how does the linker or whatever know where to get that? You know what I mean?
Where to get
standard IO.
The question is, how does the linker know where standard IO.o is? The compiler tells the linker when you're making an executable by default, here is the standard library, link it in. So given that, in our last few minutes, so here's a program. Now let's say this is main.c, and I produce main.s, main.o, main.exe, just like we did before. Which files contain the memory address, the actual memory address of say hello? So figure out the answer. You can discuss with your neighbors. I'll give you about a minute. Address of the function is. Not the string, yes. So, since we're about out of time and I don't want to go too far over, so who thinks the answer is A? Raise your hands. B, C, D, E, and F. Okay, so a split between C and D. So I think the answer is C. And the reason why it's not in the object file is that if you look at what we have here, I have that main is at where in the file it is, but I haven't decided whether where this ends up being. I don't know whether there's another object file. I don't know where in the executable it's going to be, so I can't know its memory address yet. And just because of that, there's no way I could actually write down the memory address yet, so it can't be there. Just because I could have linked something else in besides main.o, and it could be in the executable somewhere, so I haven't decided where I'm putting it yet. Yes?
If you were missing line 3 that had the put s, so you only had the function reference to the code, would it be a show or?
The question question is if this was a recursive function or. Question, no, if it wasn't memory from another function, it would still not have the memory address because we don't know where it is yet, right? The linker could decide to put other code in the file earlier.
Data or